This is Mark Gibbons. It's October 7th, 2012, and I'm conducting an interview with Roger Dunsmore about Ed Leahy. Okay, Roger. What's most important is that they can hear you. So I'll be a little faint in the background, but
okay.
I mean, let's just say, what's your first meeting or first encounter? What's the first thing that comes to mind when you think about Ed Leahy when you first encountered him?
I think it was like 64. 1964 or something, and he was, I don't know if we were both instructors in the English department, or he was a grad student at that point, and I was an instructor, but he was moving, and his dad was there, sitting in a chair watching us move. He was married to Lori at that time, and I mean, we were drinking Irish whiskey while we were moving, and we were getting fairly drunk, and his dad thought that was pretty funny. And we began to, you know, like, get chair legs caught in doorways and break them off and stuff, and it was getting sort of out of hand in terms of a moving situation. We were busting things up. I don't remember how much, but that's my earliest, you know, memory of Ed. My early memories back in the 60s are not very strong. I left Montana from 66 to 68. And so I think that moving one's the only one from pre-66 that I remember. When I came back from 68, Warwick and Bluen were here, and they were very powerful figures on the Missoula scene. And Ed was quite within their sway.
Paul Warwick and Denny Bluen.
Yeah.
But when you say their sway, what do you mean?
Well, they were just really powerful personalities, charismatic and intense and bright and creative. And it was, you know, the anti-war years, and so they were kind of the lead edge on campus of the anti-war movement at that time. And of course, Ed was always a pacifist in his public life. I think what I remember was maybe a speech by Warwick and Bluen encouraging people to turn in their draft cards and stuff. And I believe that Ed did that, turned in his draft card, maybe burned it publicly, and then was freaked out, you know, afterwards by that. I think LSD was a part of that whole matrix in that group with the anti-war movement. And I also think that, I never talked to Ed about this, but my sense is that Ed got into the LSD a bit, and that I think it was, it increased his imbalance mentally, because he did have mental problems and did four tours of duty in Warm Springs as a mental patient. And I even wondered whether or not Denny and Paul didn't feel somewhat responsible in having introduced him, as far as I knew, you know, to LSD, you know, for some of the imbalance that came out of all that time. Ed did end up in jail in the anti-war movement years, 68 to 71 or so. I know he told me later, Ed did, that he had, and this might have been earlier than that, this might have been while I was gone. I was off in Europe for a year, and I taught at a Catholic college in Kentucky for a year.
What years?
66, 68. I'd been here 63, 66, then I came back in 68 and stayed until 2005 when I moved to Dillon. But that he at some point in those 60s, he had a job teaching English at Montana Tech. And I believe he was either teaching or playing tapes of Gandhi and Gandhi's nonviolent resistance stuff. And he actually, I don't know what all caused this, whether he thought it was that, the nonviolent resistance stuff of Gandhi, but the police came to his office, handcuffed him, and led him off campus in shackles. And I think that was maybe the point at which he had a choice of whether to go to Warm Springs or into prison. And I think he chose Warm Springs. Now, I may have that a little bit skewed because I wasn't there, and it's just my memory of what Ed told me at that time. Also back there in those early years, and Ed and I, we liked each other. We were drawn to each other. But I didn't know him nearly as well in those years until after 91. That's when Ed and I really got closest, from 91 until he died. But back in those early years, he had one mental breakdown that they took him up to there was the old railroad hospital up there along where the interstate is now. And they had him in a room by himself, and he was shackled. Both arms were shackled over his head to metal bed frames, and both legs were shackled. And I remember I fed him. I had to. He couldn't feed himself because of these shackles, and so I came. They brought his dinner in, and I fed him with a spoon, you know, because his arms were shackled.
What year?
I don't know.
But you're talking about late 60s?
Probably late 60s. Yeah. And I always felt that in those years, anyway, that came between us, that there was a sense on his part of humiliation and vulnerability, and that I'd seen him in this condition of being shackled to a metal bed frame and had to feed him. So I felt it was a difficulty between us. It wasn't like, oh, it was great that you did that for me. It was like, you know, you've seen me and really in tough shape, and I'm not comfortable with that. That's, at least that was my feeling about all. He never said that as such. And so it wasn't really, those are some of the earliest memories, but it wasn't really until I came back from China in 1991. I came back at the end of July. I'd been gone for 6 or 8 months over in China. I nearly died over there. I'd had pneumonia and been in a Chinese hospital 25 days, and I'd fallen in love with a young woman over there that I had to leave behind. So when I came back, I was wrecked. I mean, I was not myself in many ways. And Dexter called me up, Dexter Roberts, and he said, you better go see Leahy. He's back in the mental ward up there in that old railroad hospital. So I went up to see him, and he wasn't shackled or anything at that point. He was ambulatory and able to move around in the mental ward. And he was really glad to see me, and I was glad to see him. And I have written about this in a poem. I felt so desolate and had such a difficult time reentering the U.S. society at that point, after that time in China and what I'd been through there, that I was only comfortable on that mental ward with him for a few weeks. And so I would go up. Well, I don't think I went every day. I think I went up maybe 3 or 4 times a week, and I just hung out with him up there. And there was the daughter of another faculty member that I was pretty close to up there who'd had a breakdown, and I can remember they had always had a bowl of apples at the nurse's station there, and Ed and I would go up and each get an apple and sit in a chair near the nurse's station and eat our apples together. But it bonded us, and I felt like I was safe in the mental ward with him in a way that I didn't feel just out generally. I was not tracking well myself at all.
That's when
that bonded us.
Your friendship developed.
Yeah. Yeah, we were friends before that, but not close. But from that point on, we were really close.
Before you then move forward into basically your close friendship with Ed until the end of his life.
Yeah.
Let's talk just for a minute about, I'm sorry, the feedback.
That's okay.
About the about the writing, as far as Ed as a poet, prior to, I mean, coming back in 90.
Yeah.
If you go backwards in time again, when did that, what did you think in terms of Ed as a poet? When did you first encounter that?
I don't know when I first encountered it, but I know that I was skeptical of it. I thought too much was made of it. I didn't get Hugo very well. Hugo was good to me, and I liked him, and he liked me, but I didn't get him as a poet. And so Ed was part of that group around Hugo. He was close to Hugo, and I was an outsider to that because I really didn't get Hugo that much. So a lot was being made of Ed's poetry as being this, you know, incredible, you know, find that Hugo had made. And I thought, well, okay. And I read this stuff, but I wasn't taken with Ed's poetry, and I wasn't taken with Hugo's poetry, and I wasn't a part of that circle. So I was ambivalent there. I liked all those guys, and I was glad to be even on the periphery of that circle, but it wasn't my circle. My circle was much more, Gary Snyder was my main teacher, and I had started reading and actually writing to him in the mid-60s, and he actually taught with us in 71 for 6 weeks in the Round River thing. And Hugo would say things like, don't write like Gary Snyder. There's only one Gary Snyder, and that's not what you want to do. And so that was, you know, explicitly verboten, and that was where my teaching was. And so I felt that people made too much of Ed's poetry, you know, at that point. And I came to reconsider that later on, and to realize how wonderful the early mining poems were. But during those early years, I didn't have that.
Did you hear him read in the early years?
I don't think I did hear him read.
I
stayed away from that. There was a kind of a, it was too much of an in-group around Hugo, and I didn't like the suction, and I didn't belong quite, and so I was trying. I was in 66, I was just writing my first poems. Hugo had already been here a couple of years, and I didn't feel adequate myself. And then Ed was one of the prizes, on the in crowd. So that was all going on in those early years, though we liked each other and I got along with everybody and I felt glad to be around them. And I think I learned from them by osmosis, but I was an outsider.
When's the first time you recall hearing Ed read?
I don't know. I would say, though, I don't recall hearing Ed read until after 91.
Okay.
And then after 91, not only did I hear him read, I drove him to readings. I occasionally read with him. I introduced him at readings. I mean, I was very much involved in his public reading life after 91.
But you came to that through friendship.
Yeah, I came to
opposed to trying to just go listen to someone.
Right. Yeah, I was a pal.
Yeah.
We were on the road together.
Right. Yeah. I just as a little side question, one of the things that I found out in Ed's life later on was that he was not aware of the fact that his father was not his father.
Yeah.
And he found this out after his father died.
Yeah.
In 1966, I believe.
Yeah, I don't know what the date is.
66, 67,
yeah,
something like that. You were probably gone at that time.
Yeah, I probably died while I was gone, yeah.
Did you know that?
I mean, oh yeah, Ed and I talked about that, but again, this was after 91. I mean, I was, you know, the difference between pre 91 and after 91 was that sense of, you know, there was a real friendship and a real intimacy came after that.
But what did he say about that?
But I think it was his mother that told him, and he talked about how it happened. Was, you know, apparently the mother and his biological father, and then his legal father, who was married to his mother, those three were involved in that I think both the Gypo mining and the bootlegging. And you know, I mean, his mother and the other guy just, you know, probably had too much drink and got it done, and Ed was born, and they sat down, and the three of them, not Ed, but the two men and the mother, and worked it out and talked it over, and they stayed friends, and it was never a thing that came to some kind of violence or separation or anything else. I mean, they understood each other, and they understood how it had happened. It was a very human kind of thing to happen. It could happen, I think, to many of us, you know, maybe not all of us, but it's not. And I always liked that about the story, that they had sort of worked it out between the three of them, and Eddie was born, and his dad always took him as his son, and that did not seem to be an issue. But I know later on, Ed, and it would be both his mother and dad were dead, but his real dad was still alive. The surrogate father, the outsider father, the real father, the guy whose semen it was, he was still alive. And Ed needed money. Ed didn't have much of anything, you know, in those years from 90, when I knew him from 91 on. Always lived on a shoestring and close to the edge. And we would talk about, well, how about, you know, your real dad, you know? Well, he had his own children, his own legal, legitimate children. And he died in that period after 91. And I don't think Ed saw anything from that. And I think, again, Ed, I think, understood that the guy took care of his own legal kids. But I also think he felt that. He felt that exclusion, you know, there too. And I don't remember what he said about it, but I knew that he felt bad about it, because he may have even gone and I don't know if he ever said anything to that guy or not, but he did hope, I know he hoped that something would come to him from that, and it didn't.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So.
I just was one of the times that Ed had a pretty good breakdown or mental sort of coming apart at the seams. I was informed by Rick and some people that the time that he found that out, that he, you know, lost it.
He had a big mental breakdown. Yeah.
A big break, and that I wondered if maybe, you know, that didn't contribute in some regard to, you know, problems that he had further down the line.
Could be.
Yeah.
When he introduced that issue to me, I don't remember what the context was, but I remember he said it like, I'm a bastard. And I said, no, what do you mean you're a bastard? Well, you know, my father's not my father, and my mother's told me this. But what always impressed me about that story was that the three of them, those three adults, worked that out seemingly pretty well and pretty congenially, and they were partners, and they stayed partners, and they didn't have a big brouhaha, as far as I could tell,
right,
you know, around it.
And the story was kept secret to protect Ed.
Yeah.
More than anything.
Yeah.
I would imagine.
Ed was, and for me, one of the things I think that happened to me after 91 was I was not, up until 91, I had a couple books of poetry out, and that was pretty much it. And I was saw myself more as a teacher, and I was very insecure and inadequate in myself as a poet. And I knew Ed was this legendary poet figure, you know, in Montana. And one of the things that happened in my relationship with him was that he valued my poetry. And he really helped me gain confidence as a writer. And sometimes he would chastise me when I would have a reading that only three people showed up in at, and I kind of limp through the reading, and he'd give me hell. He'd say, "God damn you, you know, and you do the same best reading as if there's 100 people there, just because 3 people showed up. That one person that needs to be there is probably there, you know." And he taught me those kind of things. But I was always surprised that he valued my work as a poet, because I undervalued it and was insecure. And I think in terms of our friendship, that might be the most important thing that happened for me in the friendship, was that my confidence in myself as a writer was nurtured by him. He nurtured that.
Right.
And just, you know, not, I don't even know that he was consciously aware of trying to do that. But he did.
I would guess that he recognized the value in your work. And one of the things, when you say confidence, one of the things that comes to my mind is that Ed had an incredible amount of confidence.
Yeah.
About poetry.
Yeah.
And about,
yeah,
that passion and that confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
For what he was into. He, yeah, was.
Yeah.
You know, for a man that was as,
yeah, well, he was gifted, and I think that was recognized early on, and I think that he knew that.
Yeah.
He knew that, even though it meant things like when he won the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship and went off to Madison, Wisconsin on one of those, and it was, I'm not sure what all the details were, but he didn't manage to follow through on that. He had to leave and come back to Montana. But I also think he knew that, and I think he was a runner-up in the Rhodes Scholar applications and confidence coming out of Missoula. And so he knew that he was gifted intellectually and creatively. And, you know, one of the stories that he told that I have always loved was that, I don't know if it was his first time in Warm Springs State Mental Hospital or second time or third time, but probably not the fourth time. Leslie Fiedler, who had been his mentor here for years and who really saw Ed's power as a writer and a thinker, wrote to the head psychiatrist at Warm Springs. And Ed was very proud of this. And he had said to the head psychiatrist, "Now you let Ed Leahy have whatever thoughts he wants to have or needs to have. Don't you mess with them. You let him have free rein in terms of his mind." And I've always thought that was Ed was proud of that and loved Leslie for it. And I always thought that was great of Fiedler to do that, you know, that kind of recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think of that first part of that short story,
Queen Wilhelmina's. Yeah.
Where him and the psychiatrist are,
yeah,
at the interview.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's an incredible piece of,
yeah,
writing.
Yeah, yeah, that needs
clarity
to.
Clarity.
Yeah. That whole piece needs to have more visibility. I don't know how we'll do that, but he will. He was also supportive of me, and I have not been a very successful person in terms of marriages. And my present wife Jenny Faline and I got together at the end of 95, the last week of 95, and we struggled, you know, quite a bit in our first few years. And two things happened that separated Ed and I. Because between 91 and the end of 95, Ed and I were like, I wouldn't say married, but we were like, yeah, brothers, and saw each other all the time, did all kind of stuff together. Go out to Frenchtown Pond and go swimming together. He loved to swim. We'd go up to Little Hot Springs and swim. And what was amazing about Ed in those kind of instances was there were no lines of separation between him and particularly females. And they all loved him. And God, before I would know it, he'd have some gal up at Little Hot Springs that he was seeing and going up there without me, you know, and I'd feel a little funny. But when Jenny came onto the picture with me, that meant Ed and I spent quite a bit less time together, you know, and it happened pretty quickly, you know. And I think both he and I felt that loss, although I was caught up in a new romance, so it probably didn't affect me as much as it did him. But when Jenny and I would struggle, and I'd be bereft or upset or confused or just pissed off or, you know, whatever you get, I'd go talk to him about it. And what was great about that, he was a tremendous counselor. He never sided with me against her. You know, he always supported that relationship. He really liked her. And wouldn't let me just draw him into joining up with me to be real critical toward her. You know, he wouldn't do that, and that was great. I mean, because I could go there when I was a mess. I could go there when I was depressed and confused and fucked up and angry, and he would listen and he would support the relationship, and he'd help me, and he liked her. And I think he was a major catalyst for her and I staying together in the early years when we were bouncing off each other pretty hard at times. And I always valued that, even though it cost him. I mean, he was the one who lost the more daily kind of time with me once that happened. But I don't know if she and I would have made it through those first couple of years if I hadn't had that kind of a counselor, you know. A really good friend. I could go there when I didn't want anybody else to see me because I was a mess. But I could always go to see Ed, and I did it. I availed myself of that probably more than is fair.
When you've seen someone shackled to a
friend, yeah, oh Christ,
you feel comfortable to air your worst nightmares.
Yeah,
I have a couple of things that I want to ask.
Yeah,
I forget about them.
Yeah,
and two stories. One being, you know, Ed. We know in later years developed what was, you know, a tremor.
Yeah.
And then I remember it was false Parkinson's. And then, could you elaborate on what you know about that whole business with Ed's?
The tremor stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I would say, one thing I would say about it is it really added to his readings.
Yeah.
I mean, to have this great big fat guy up there shaking and sweating and just looking like death warmed over, and then out of him was coming this incredible Irish voice that was the best reading voice you'd ever hear, and the contrast between the voice and the shaking and the sweating and stuff was just stunning. And so I think it really did add to it. But it got so bad he couldn't type. It got so bad that he couldn't write anymore because his hands were shaking too much. And nobody could figure out what it was. And I don't know which doctor or quite how he figured it out, but he did sit down with one doctor who said to him, after Ed described his symptoms, said to him, "I've never known a person with your symptoms who didn't work around manganese." And did you ever work around manganese? Well, yeah. You know, he had unloaded gondola cars with manganese, and the way he'd done it, he'd been probably 16 or 17. He'd been pretty young. And they would take these gondola cars, and they would dump them. I guess they had a device where they turn it over and dump them. Or maybe the bottom opened up and they dumped them. But he would crawl up inside after they were dumped with a big sledgehammer, a 5 or 10 pound sledge, and beat on the walls of those gondola cars to knock all the dust out. And, you know, there was no safety stuff. There was no masks or breathers or anything else. So he was breathing in that manganese dust. And he was getting, I don't know, $10 a day and thinking it was big wages and that he was the king of the hill. But it came in, and that manganese poisoning, you know, got into his central nervous system. And this guy started giving him beta blockers. I don't know quite what they are, but and the beta blockers did allow him to. I don't think the tremors ever went away, but they certainly were reduced and managed to the point where he could write. He could use a typewriter. He could hold a pen. And I think I know they didn't ever go away because they were still quite useful in readings. You know, I mean, I don't know if he kind of would slip back into a little extra tremor there to sort of jazz his audience or not. But yeah, he still, I noticed him most when he read after that, even though he could still write.
The other question I wanted to ask is about, you know, you said you, I know you guys went swimming a lot and you loved going to Lolo Hot Springs. You loved the hot springs because he was in pain.
Isn't yeah.
It? And you know, he had a car accident, he told me. And do you know, could you add
no, about that? I don't know about the car accident, but I know he had a lot of aches and pains. I mean, and the hot springs made him feel better. We also went to the one outside Butte. Begins with an F. I want to call it Fairhaven or
Fairmont.
Yeah, we'd go to Fairmont, but Fairmont was a little too developed and too fancy, and it was more fun to go up to Lolo Hot Springs. And he actually got to somewhere in the mid-90s there. He had his own little pickup truck, and he would go up there by himself quite a bit, too. Mm-hmm. And he had one girlfriend that lived in a cabin up there, and God, that was always amazing. One of my favorite times coming back from Lolo Hot Springs with him was we'd stop. There was a little mom-pa grocery store down the road 10 miles. We stopped in there and bought a six-pack of beer, cans of beer, and we both drank one, and he threw his out the window after he was done drinking. And I was an environmentalist, you know, helped found the wilderness program and all that jazz, and it kind of startled me. I figured he was environmentally conscious, too, so we each drank a second one. He threw the second one out the window. I thought I made the first one. And I said, oh, Christ, lady, you know, what are you throwing those empty cans out the window for? I mean, that's littering and stuff. And he said, well, he said, we got to get rid of the evidence. I went, and the light went on. I went, bingo. So, by God, I started throwing mine out the window, too. I got you, got to get rid of no open containers. I never thought I'd be throwing beer
cans.
Yeah. Never thought I'd be throwing empty beer cans out the window to get rid of the evidence. But, yeah, and I loved that about him. I mean, he was coming from such a different place. And I feel like I learned a lot, you know, from that, that we had these little, what you're supposed to and not supposed to, and he had a whole other set of rules that came from somewhere else, and some of them were pretty good. He also saw, I think he was pretty astute with people's character. One of the troubles that Jenny and I had is she hates being mothered. And he said, well, Christ, he said, Dunsmore, you know, you are fatherly motherly, and you've got to get over being fatherly motherly. And he often called me fatherly motherly. And when are you going to stop being fatherly motherly? And I think that was true, and I think it helped me to sort of toughen up in my relationship with my wife, to not be so fatherly motherly. But I still have a great deal of affection for that phrase, and I think he did see, you know, clearly that, yeah. Too fatherly motherly.
Yeah. Well, do you want to take a quick break here?
Yeah, let's take a quick break.
All right, we're back.
A couple of my most intimate times with him were, well, God, there were several, and some are positive and some are negative. And I don't mean any disrespect, but some of these stories do paint him in not the greatest light, but they're real stories. I mean, and they're stories of closeness. I was with him when he sold his house in Butte. And this was a house he'd owned with his second wife, Kay, I think her name was. And it was a two-story house. I think it was mostly stone. He had worked on it for years, you know, patching it up and carpentry work and painting. And he'd also bought all kind of things at the secondhand stores to furnish it. And they had broken up. And I think at the time he was living in Anaconda, because he had been in Missoula for a little while, and then he'd gone back to Anaconda for a while, and then he did move back to Missoula. It wasn't easy for him to leave that Butte Anaconda area, but he finally did settle here. But decided to sell the house, and he sold it to Kay's family. And I remember we went in to the house. I don't know if I was in the house with him, and then we went down to the lawyer's office, and he sold this house, which was a pretty nice Butte house, I think, for $7,500. And they were saying, "Oh, are you sure?" And he was saying, "Yes." And so I took him aside and I said, "No, Ed, you know, this is a very low price for this house. It's a two-story house. Don't you put a lot of years? Are you sure?" "Yeah." And I don't know how he got the price for that house in mind. And I wondered about them, you know. I mean, like, I wondered why they didn't say, "Oh, we just need to pay you at least twice that. We need to pay you at least $15,000 or something." I mean, that would have been a steal, too. But I didn't try to talk him out of it. I've never been that kind of person. I mean, I questioned him about it.
What year?
Would have been early 90s, probably 92, 93, right in there. And then come to find out, the house had all his mother's paintings in it. So Kay had those paintings. He didn't have his own mother's paintings, and she'd been quite a good painter her whole life. And so at some point he asked me if I would go back and get the paintings for him. So I went back and talked to Kay, and I had a little pickup truck, and picked up, I don't know, maybe a dozen paintings. And she was nice. I liked Kay. She was a good person. I didn't think her family was bad, but I just thought that was odd, and it didn't seem right. But he wanted to do it, and he wanted to do it for that. And I felt glad to be with him during that period of time to at least question it, and then able to do the pickup on the paintings. And then the painting that he had of her, his mom, that he seemed, I think he liked the best, but maybe it was just I liked it the best. I don't know. But it's that laughing Christ. It was a kind of wild laughing Christ that he always had on the wall, and Christ looking like a gypsy or something, you know. It was a good, strong laugh and energy. And that seemed to be, Ed had that spirit. Another time we were real close, and this is probably, if I should even tell this story, but we went up to Jack Waller's place, Ed and I. I think Ed was maybe going to give a reading that night in Phillipsburg, and this is before Jack moved to Virginia City. And Jack had this cabin, I think, up outside of Phillipsburg. And one of Ed's old girlfriends showed up, old lovers showed up, and the three of us were sitting on the bed, and we were drinking a fifth of whiskey, and we all got pretty drunk. And it really did look like we were going to have a threesome there. I mean, which I've never had in my life, but it was just we were drifting towards that, you know. And Waller came in. Oh, we were surprised. Here were the three of us were on his big queen-size bed, half drunk. And I think we all still had our clothes on. But I don't know what would have happened. Not in our minds. And I don't know what would have happened if Walter had to come in. Now, that's, you know, I mean, and I think, well, God, what will people think? What will my wife think? What will his daughters think? Well, you know, I mean, should I even tell stories like that? But some of my most fondest memories of him are like that, yeah. You know. So maybe the most fondest ones was after Jenny and I were together. And he was living in that, whatever it was, down there at the corner of Orange and Front Street. There was for old people on the river.
Clark Fork
Manor, whatever it was. And he was beginning to get more slovenly, although I suppose he probably was always a little slovenly, you know. But he, I went over, I think it was his birthday, and this, which is July, what, 6th or 8th, yeah. I went over to take him to breakfast for his birthday, and I don't remember if he met me at the VFW Club. Is that the bar that's just down there? Yeah, if he met me there, if we walked over there from his apartment. But he hadn't changed his shirt, you know, in a month. And it was crusted. I mean, it had a half inch of dried crust like an apron from, you know, the neck down, shoulder width all the way to the belt line. And I remember feeling self-conscious in the bar. I mean, what were people going to think of me sitting with this guy who had this shirt on that was had a breastplate that was totally crusted food on it? And again, I don't mean any disrespect to him for this, but I was concerned about him, but I was also concerned about what people would think. Who the hell was this that I was with? And so I said to him, Ed, we were going to go across the street to eat at the shack. And I said, you know, how long you had that shirt on? Oh, I don't know, a month maybe, he said. And I said, well, you know, don't you think we ought to, for your birthday before we go to the shack, you want to go up and get a clean shirt on? No, you know, there's no need, you know. So we went across the street and ate with it. And there's something about that that's, I don't feel critical of him for that. I it's something touching about that for me, and I'm not, that's not quite the right word, you know, but and an extension of it was I drove him to Butte. He had Burton Oli is the dentist in Butte. I don't know if that's the right name or not, but there's a Italian family who runs a dentist there in Butte, and that guy did Ed's teeth pro bono, you know, for free for years, and the teeth were in terrible shape. I mean, he was gluing them in and taking them out and carving on them and never charged him anything. He took good care of Ed for many, many years. And so I would drive Ed over, and we'd go to the dentist, and then we'd always go up and eat in the Chinese place up on Broadway or Park. Peking. It wasn't the Peking, because what was interesting, and I think Ed was right on this, that this other place, which didn't have the longevity of the Peking, and it didn't have the Chinese. The cook in this other Chinese place was Mexican, but he was a really good Chinese cook, even though he's Mexican. And it was better food than the Peking. So we'd always eat together there. And we were going over one time to, well, God, a couple of things. Drink, Jesus, you know, we'd stop in Drummond, and he'd go in and he'd buy a pint of vodka, and we'd get back in the car and he would just chug it, just straight down, not all of it, about two-thirds of it, so get ready for the dentist. And then when we'd come out of the dentist, he'd chug the last third and it was left, just right straight down, just chug it. And I'd never seen anybody drink like that. I mean, I know people do drink like that, but I never quite drank like that. I mean, it was really amazing. And then we'd go up and eat at this other Chinese restaurant, which is out of business now. I can't remember the name of it. But one time we were going over there to the dentist, and he had another one of these shirts on. It had this whole, like, body armor of crusted food on it. And I said to Matt, I said, you know, you're going over to Butte, you're going to the dentist, it'd probably be good if you, you know, didn't walk in there with that quarter inch of dried food all over the front of your shirt. Would you mind if we stop in Deer Lodge and I scrape that off and clean you up? Oh, that'd be great, he said. Sure, go ahead. So we pulled into a gas station there, and I think I took the scraper for the windshield, and I scraped his shirt off, And then I had a rag of some kind in the car, and then I got water from the windshield washer at the gas pumps, and I wiped his shirt down. It was summertime; it wasn't winter or anything, you know. And cleaned it up fairly well, actually, you know. But I for me, that was an intimate time with him. That was really close, and I value that kind of time with him, you know. And it was like I felt like I could do something for him. I felt like he accepted that from me. He knew I didn't judge him, but I did want him to be a little bit more cleaned up before he went into a public place like a dentist's office, you know. But I guess for me, as much as anything, that scraping that dried food off his shirt front on the way to Butte, I have great affection for that memory. And for that's a metaphor for the way we felt about each other.
Yeah,
you know. Even
this is kind of a leading question, but would you? I'm sure you would say that his poetry reflected that sort of change in him, as you know. I mean, you talked about your relationship with him early on. And the power of his poetry coming out of the Hugo workshops and out of his, you know, he wins the first book award in 79. He's the next greatest thing.
To Hugo.
In Montana poetry. And then we see the later years, the 1990s, the apples rolling on the lawn was 99 almost. I think the end of the 90s when that little chapbook finally came out. And there was a long period of time there with nothing. So,
yeah.
I mean, the difference in those poems and the difference in your relationship, or at least the more intimate.
Yeah, the poems are more intimate. The poems are more intimate. It's not like, I mean, I love Gimpo Leary's Ironworks. I include it in every anthology I make for students. It's a great poem. It's a great poem about poetry, but it's a great poem about poetry that also honors the ordinary artistry of a mining welder. And it never makes that as a metaphor for poetry without ever undermining just the real gritty, nitty work.
What I always loved about that poem is that it seems to elevate the poetry, the artistry of poetry to that of the author.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a terrific poem. But the later poems have a different feel, and the one for Mary Laurie in the Safeway, where the bird is in the store and gets caught in a fan and is reduced to a bunch of feathers down around his feet, where you feel there's Ed's acknowledgement of his own just being a bird that's been shredded by the fan of life, you know, and yet he loves his grandchild, he loves his estranged wife almost as much as he hates her, or whatever the line is. And I think some of the other poems in there, in those later works too, torn orange that he takes out of the street and puts on a blue saucer and takes home. Oh man, I love that poem. It's one of my favorite ones. I will say this about that anthology. Chapbook that comes out in the 90s, maybe it is in the late 90s, Ed had not published anything since the first Montana Book Award, The Blind Horses. And I don't think he would have, but the guy who did that was named Waldrop.
Hal Waldrop.
And Hal Waldrop was an old friend of Ed's from way back. He worked as an aide out at the mental institution. And he just felt bad that Ed did not have any poems out there after Blind Horses. And so he did that. I mean, he actually did the physical labor to it. He paid for it out of his own pocket. And he is the one who reopened Ed's Publishing from that point on. And I think that gets forgotten. Everybody looks at Russell Chatham's book or the one that the university bookstore did, you know, that has Jenny's drawing on the cover of the horses leaping out of the typewriter. But it was Hal Waldrop who deserves the credit, you know, for reopening that. And that was really important. And I think, I remember I took some photos of Ed. I don't know if it was for that one or the horses leaping out of the typewriter. And Ed and I would walk along the river there in Missoula, the Cock Fork, and we'd walk along on the both sides. But there was a lot of great graffiti down under the bridges. Mm-hmm. Of course, they've all the politically correct assholes have gone and covered up with naval gunboat paint and stuff, gray and stuff, because they don't understand the artistry in the graffiti. But I remember taking a photo of Ed standing next to a face that was a graffiti face on one of those bridges under the bridges under the bridges there along the river. And the face must have been 5 or 6 feet tall. And Ed stood next to it, but it was about as tall as he was. I think we used it in one of those books. I don't know. I'd have to go look and see. But he understood the underground. He understood graffiti art. He understood what was under the bridges, you know, real well.
He understood art, I think.
Yeah. And I love that story about him, and I think I tell this in that article on Four Montana Poets. Mm-hmm. So maybe we shouldn't bother with it, but he's at a powwow in Deer Lodge.
Oh, yeah.
And the Indians have taken a buffalo into the butcher.
Right.
Yeah, should I even bother to tell
them?
And the butcher, the agreement was he was going to do it for free for them, but then he took half of it to pay himself without negotiating with them about that. And so when Ed heard this story, it was just like Ed. You know, he went right to that butcher and told him that he was a disgrace to his own race. And he needed to give that half of bison back to those Indians, which he did. He shamed this guy into that, and that's when the Indians then gave him that nickname of Silver Tongue, which was sort of a tongue-in-cheek, double-edged, you know, name. But I think a very revealing story. And he told stories of when he was jailed for his anti-war stuff, having guys in the prison. He talked about being, I think he was either in the shower or the pisser, and some guy starting in on him, and a little tiny Mexican guy telling the other guy to step back and leave Ed alone right now. And the other guy that was bothering him did, and how much he felt he owed to guys like that, little Mexican guys he met in jail, you know, who stood up for him just because they didn't like what was going on. So he had that kind of, that basic sense of justice that's at that level, you know, the level of the guys in jail. And people did take care of him. And he said Warm Springs back in the, I don't know, the 60s or 70s, it was way overcrowded, you know, I mean, twice as many people as it was built to hold. The halls were just filled with seriously psychotic and schizophrenic people that were scary as hell, and he was terrified, and you had to watch your back. And I don't remember any particular stories of anybody standing up for him, but I'm sure that that went on, you know, in there too. You know, people taking care of each other.
That's the Irish in him, I think.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a lot of that comes from that. That background. Well, I'm thinking here.
I've got that poem about, you know, he flew. And his mother flew. And, you know, that's widely known that she was one of the earliest women pilots, maybe the earliest in the state. And then she dropped the fixings for the moonshine that they were making so that the revenuers couldn't follow her up the draws and stuff. But there's a little spring outside of Anaconda as you're going up towards Georgetown Lake. There's a really nice little spring along the highway. You just pull off there. And Ed always, he always wanted to stop there whenever we took that back road over to Anaconda or back road to Butte. And we'd fill up, you know, a jug of water at that spring. And I remember that there was a guy parked there when we came down one time with his wife and had a couple of kids in the car. And for some reason, I don't know how this story came out, and maybe I just put these together in a poem, but it's Ed was telling me about a time he saw a crop duster crash. I think you've seen this poem of mine, although it may not have been published ever. I didn't put it in.
What's the title?
I'd be damned if I know what the title is. It's okay. But he said, and it was this guy in this car down by this spring outside Anaconda somehow reminded us of this crop dusting story. But he said he saw a crop duster. He'd snagged, when he came in to crop dust, he'd snagged his wheels on a telephone line. And then instead of going down, he gunned it, you know, gunned the motors. And I remember Ed going, you know, gunning those motors. And the guy was starting to pull wire, and he must have been hauling like 1,000 foot of wire before it got him, and he crashed and burned. And Ed talked about how he knew the guy had kids. I mean, I don't know what all he knew about him or anything. But that was a moving story, particularly coming from someone who talked about his own difficulties flying and the number of people that get killed in flying in Montana for various reasons. And so when I came to write that poem, I wrote it about this guy at the spring where we were getting water, being that guy and the wife with his, in the car with his wife and his kids and stuff. But so that was a story around which I made a poem, but around which he had a great story, you know. And then he has that Icarus poem, and he has all those stories about his mom flying and stuff too.
One of the things, I guess, that's so when you're talking about someone who is a masterful storyteller, and Ed was a masterful storyteller, one of the things that strikes me is that I realize sometimes in communications, in talking about that person who's told me stories, and is that maybe some of these stories actually didn't happen.
Yeah.
He really thinks that they did because of, you know, possibly, you know, we all have that kind of, sometimes we take on other people's stories and think that we were actually there after a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, Ed had some mental issues.
Yeah,
Some of that may have been, you know, hallucination.
Yeah, yeah.
Invention. Yep. Do you have any, does anything come to mind?
Oh, sure.
A special one?
Well, I even wondered, you know, he would talk about how Leslie Fiedler would go into the bars in Woody Street and Indian wrestle on the floor with guys, and I've repeated that story, and it's gotten the newspaper, actually. And I got to thinking, well, I don't know if that's really a Leslie Fiedler story or that's just an Ed Leahy story, you know. But we were up in Butte at some kind of reading. Ed was a primary poet figure, and we all went over to this Chinese restaurant with the Mexican cook that was better than the Peking. And Waller was with us, and we were sitting around the table, and Ed started saying about, well, he'd been up at the courthouse, and it was heavily guarded, and the judge had called him up, and they were going to have a seminar on his poetry. And it went on for a while. I don't remember all, but it was obviously, we'd been with him, you know, and it was out there, and I think, but what did it mean? I mean, probably he'd have loved to have had a seminar on his poetry. And maybe that's what we were having around that table in that Chinese restaurant.
And if you didn't know the difference, you could have possibly believed it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I found some of those stories.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they were just so rational.
Jack Waller had come to Missoula, he said, to visit him. But he wasn't sure he wanted to see him because Waller was running a car stealing ring. He'd seen Waller, you know, and a sidekick. He'd picked off a pink Cadillac or something that had been parked by the courthouse, and were going to drive it back to Anaconda and sell it and stuff. And Jesus, you know. And at first you think, Jesus, I wonder if Waller is, you know. And then you But yeah.
Make a good movie.
Yeah. Yeah, but he had that side to him, and you didn't know, and you got taken in by it, usually for a while anyway, or to some.
Tell a story.
Oh yeah, and it was real, and it probably was real for him.
Well, anything else that you can think of that you want to say, or say anything in kind of conclusion? For this thing, and then we can always do another one at another time if we think we want to.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't. Not much. I guess the main thing I would say about him is I owe him a great debt, just because of my own his help to me. In terms of making me believe in myself, or helping me believe in myself, and his help to me in terms of teaching me to throw empty beer cans out the window so I didn't get caught with the evidence. But and thirdly, I think my marriage. I mean, I think he really helped me to survive the early years of my marriage, the marriage I'm in now. And I needed somebody And I think he helped me survive when I came back from China that first time, when I was just, I'd nearly died, and I'd left behind a young half-Muslim Chinese woman I didn't want to leave. And so I just hung out with him in the mental ward, you know, where I was safe. But he was a good friend. I mean, and the other thing I'd say about Ed, he was regardless of what the flaws he had, or how well he was able to follow through, say, in his family on what his deepest insights were, he was a Buddhist. He was a Buddhist, and he read the Buddhist literature. He took the Buddhist journals monthly. And was very serious and thoughtful, you know, about that. And I remember when he got the governor's award, we were standing in the Capitol building in Helena, in the rotunda. And the governor got up and said, blah, 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 and, you know, it was all this presentation stuff. And when Ed got up, and he was shaking pretty good then, And he also was walking with a cane at that point. And the governor kind of had this sort of phony smile on his face, you know, kind of enjoying it in a condescending kind of way, was the way it seemed to me as an outsider. But Ed stood up there at the podium, and the first thing he did was condemned capital punishment. And the second thing that he did was condemn the war in Iraq. And I was really moved by his willingness to do those two things in that very political place and in front of those people, and to use whatever award he got as the occasion to make that kind of statement. I really...
Moral statement.
Yeah, very moral. He always had that moral thing. And I'm sure that... You know, people who had to live with him and maybe see him at his worst would see the contradictions between the public moral statement and some of the interior of the life. But nevertheless, we've all got our contradictions, you know. And he was able to, as an old man at that point and somewhat shaky and stuff, he never flinched. He didn't blink.
Give him a chance to say something.
Yeah, he didn't flinch. So those are just a few other things.
Yeah, all right. I think if we want to do another one of these at some point, we can. If I think of something that we didn't cover. I mean, you know, a lot of the stories that come to my mind, they've already been chronicled in other writing and in poems, and I'm, you know, you have letters with Ed too that I'm sure sooner or later you'll probably donate to the archive.
I should figure that out.
If you have letters from Ed, you know, yeah. I mean, in Ed's hands,
I
those,
should
those kinds of things.
I should have them. Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. No. My pleasure. I wish, and I don't have anything else in the top of my head right now, but I'm sure stuff will come to me, you know. Yeah. Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, oh, sure, yeah.
He really taught me a lot of stuff, and I often didn't understand it when he first said it, but one of the things he said was, you know, I'm not a part of any church. And he said, and that includes the church of poetry.
Yeah.
You know, and at first, it took me a while to figure out what the hell he was talking about, you know. But, and I think that would go for the church of Buddhism, too. I mean, he was a person who, for whom poetry and Buddhism both were very, very, very important. But he understood, he kept his, he didn't want to be institutionalized. Even though he'd been in Warm Springs four times, maybe that's why. But he understood the need for a kind of independence from joining the group, you know, and becoming then a person who was labeled, you know, in a certain way. And so, I think that comes to me often is, the Church of Poetry. I mean, I see people joining the Church of Poetry every fucking day, you know. I just saw it this weekend, you know, the Church of Poetry over there. And he was larger than that.
Yeah.
He was larger than that. So, and the other thing that comes to mind is the last time I saw him, you know, about 12 hours before he choked to death at the end of the hall behind a locked door, I came in and I said, well, how are you doing, you know, that night? And he said, not too bad. And we went on and talked about a few other things, and not too long, 15 minutes, and I left. But I hear that phrase, every time I hear that phrase, not too bad, I go right back to that moment of 12 hours before he choked to death. And every time I say it, I'll say it sometimes, and it's just like one of those phrases now that's just set in flesh, burnt into the flesh. So, yeah, not too bad. He was not, he was not ready to die, and he was not going to die. I mean, even though he'd been laid up in a bed for a couple of years, at least by that point, he'd have gone on some more, and he'd have been able to go on some more, and the quality of life was slipping, you know, and had gone pretty far down. But he wasn't at death's door when he died, and that was unfortunate that they had him alone in a room at the end of a hall and behind a locked door.
Yeah, or
he wasn't doing too bad. Not too bad, he said. You know.
Yeah.
Anyhow. So those are a couple other things.
Good.
Yeah.